Okay, so we are on chapter 18. But before we get there, I just want to, now that the birth of Isaac is about to be announced, and thereby the Jewish people, and so the whole purpose of the Torah for being, is about to come into view, I want to point out to you something that some of the commentators touch on. And you can really only see this if you have the Hebrew text and can read the letters. You don't have to understand the meaning. But I just want to point out one word. If you go to chapter 2 of Genesis, verse 4. This is the summary of creation. Creation has been accomplished. You got a heaven, you got an earth, you got lights, you got plants, you got people. Then it says, verse 4 as a summary, what's called resumptive repetition. It brings you back to the story. It repeats what just happened. Eile toldot ha-shamayim v'ha'aretz. This is the story of the heavens and the earth. And then the next word is behi bar'am, in their creation. But those of you who can read Hebrew, if you rearrange the letters of the word behi bar'am, you get Avraham. So say the rabbis, what was the purpose of creation? It was to bring forth Abraham. And when I was looking at that, it reminded me of two things. The first was, years ago I had read an essay by William James, which, with the miracle of Google, I found in about a second and a half. All I had to do was type in James and Goodman, and it came up. It was an essay on college education wherein William James says the whole purpose of a college education is to enable you to recognize a good man when you see one. In other words, the idea of a college education is not, now James is a philosopher, so he's less inclined towards technical skill than he is towards human comprehension. And the same thing here, almost like the purpose of creation is to create a tzaddik, it's to create a good man. And it reminded me of a story that is a story from the Jewish Theological Seminary that has been told for years and years, that when Louis Finkelstein, who was the chancellor of the seminary for 25 years, when he came there as a student, when he was very young, the chancellor of the seminary was Solomon Schechter. And Schechter interviewed Finkelstein for admission to the seminary. And he said to him, why have you come to the seminary to study? And Finkelstein said, because I want to learn, you know, how to study Talmud better. And he said, no, you can do that in a lot of places. Why have you come to the seminary to study? And he said, well, because I want to learn Jewish practice. And he said, no, you can do that in a lot of places. And this went on. And finally, Finkelstein said, I don't know, Professor Schechter, why have I come to the seminary to study? And Schechter said, you have come to the seminary to associate with great men. Schechter, too, had that idea that, in fact, it is the human association and not the technical skill that is the end and purpose of education. The same thing as William James. And it reminded me of it. It almost suggests that the purpose of creation is the production of Avraham, that it was all leading up to this. Yes, that's why we come here, right. So that we can learn about the production of Avraham. I'm not going to take it any further than that.
Interesting, if you can see the fact that you have to rearrange, you have a sense that that's important.
Well,
evolution, or
maybe you would obviously have to rearrange or it would remain the same word. So on a practical level, it's necessary, although sometimes you can get a variation of what the word means, often, in fact, if you change the vocalization, if you change the vowels. So I don't know. I would have to look at a chart at what you have to put where to get Avraham to see. Yeah. This is a long discussion about the questions of tea, what are called Ketiv and Kriv, the way that the Masorah, the way that the Hebrew text comes down to us, has certain letters that are smaller, certain letters that are bigger. And if you look at the very bottom of the page, you see there's a little, there's an asterisk, and then at the bottom there's a little Hebrew phrase. It says, Hey Zi'ira, a little hey, Lefi Nuschaim Hamakubalim, according to the accepted versions. So most manuscripts have the little hey, and you will get you'll get different interpretations about why that is. I mean, hey usually represents God's name, but I don't remember now whether we looked at any of the interpretations when we looked at it, but I can take a look. I didn't bring any books with me that would say. Do any of you have in the Eitz Chaim, if you have it, or the stone, does it say anything about the little hay in verse 2:4 in Genesis? If anyone finds anything, you can let us know. Okay. Nope. All right. So let's go back to our text, which is chapter 18, verse 1. What does it say? Because the hay gets added. Had a hay added to it. The hay is small to symbolize the fact that Abram's name gets a hay added to it. So they connect it up with it. All right. That works. It works for us. So we are on chapter 18, verse 1. Now, I'm going to read the first couple of verses and then point out what the problem is that we will be dealing with at first. It says, "The Lord appeared to him by the terebinths of Mamre, and he was sitting at the entrance of the tent as the day grew hot. Looking up, he saw three men standing near him." So what's the problem? What's that? Okay, why three? Is that the same as God appearing to him? It says God appeared to him and he saw three men. Are the three men the same as God? And if they're not the same as God, then why is it this is the only time that God appears to someone and doesn't say anything? It's usually God appears to him and said, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, whatever it is, right? Go to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. Or explain this rule to the people. But this just says God appeared and that's it. So we have a couple of problems here, which is what happened with Avraham? Why does God appear to Avraham? And why, when God appears to Avraham, does it all of a sudden turn into three people who will apparently be angels? Although that too is an interesting question that we will talk about. Okay, so let's start with the theme of the whole chapter. The beginning of the chapter is going to be the announcement of what? The birth of Isaac. Okay. Now, when it says, and this actually is, let me start with a question, and then we'll get to the answer. It says, God appeared to him. Who did God appear to? How do you know? It just says God appeared to him. How do you know it was Abraham? There aren't that many other people around. That's a good point. But no, seriously, how do you know it's not, say, Lot? I mean, later on you find out it's Abraham, right? Later on you find out that it's Abraham. But when I say to you, this is actually it's a very common sense question, okay? If I say to you, you know, walking here, I met, I met Joe. And I was talking to Joe, and I said to Joe so-and-so, and he said to me, who's the he in that sentence? Joe. And how do you know that? Because it connects what happened before, okay? Because this is a new chapter, but it uses he instead of Avraham, you've got to assume that there's something about what just happened that's relevant to what's going on now. What just happened? Avraham was just circumcised. So the text, in a very subtle way, is putting into our minds that Abraham was just circumcised and God appears to him. So why would God appear to someone who was just circumcised? Bikur Cholim. The rabbis assume that God is performing the mitzvah of visiting the sick. That's why he doesn't say anything. God appears to see how Avram is doing. After all, get circumcised at 99 years old, it's a very serious operation, I've been told. And that's a nice, it's a nice idea. That, and that's what the Midrash says and Rashi says. I'm going to come to other ideas in a minute. But most sources that you look at will say God was performing this mitzvah of Bikur Cholim and showing us how important Bikur Cholim is. And anybody who has ever been sick knows how important the mitzvah is. It's very hard to know how the mitzvah is if you've only performed it. But if you've been the recipient of it, you can see that it makes a big difference much of the time for someone to come. And the biggest part of the difference is that you took the trouble to come. Right? That's the biggest part. The biggest part is that God actually came to see Avraham. That's the statement. Doesn't have to say anything. It's his appearance. And in fact, there's a very nice, the Amshanova Rebbe, who was a Hasidic rabbi, has a very nice sort of clever, there's a whole category of rabbinic statements, of Hasidic statements that are what we would call tongue-in-cheek. They're not entirely serious, but they teach a lesson. He said, why, if Abraham was sick, why didn't God heal him? How come God only came to visit? Couldn't God come to visit and say, you're better? And his answer was, God didn't want to water down the meaning and purpose of Bikur Cholim by acting like a professional doctor. He said, doctors don't do Bikur Cholim. Doctors come to heal. But the point of this was God was doing Bikur Cholim. And you don't do Bikur Cholim and then give somebody medicine. You do Bikur Cholim by just visiting. That's Bikur Cholim. God's professional function is separate. So as I said, he said it sort of tongue-in-cheek, but that tradition is very powerful, and you can see where it comes from. One of the reasons why it's good to study together is because sometimes a rabbi will get up on Shabbat morning and say something like, even God does Bikur Cholim. God visits Abraham when he's sick. And people say, oh, that's a very nice tradition. But you can see here how the tradition grew up. Because it says he, which connects you to what happened in the last chapter, because God comes but doesn't say anything or do anything, which must mean that God's purpose was just to be there. And the only logical thing is, since Abraham was just circumcised at 99, God's there because of Bikur Cholim. So the traditions come from somewhere, but all too often they get cut off in the telling and we don't see the source. All right, so that's one possibility. Now, remember when he looks up, he sees the three angels, okay? And the three angels are there, according again to the Midrash, one to announce the birth of Isaac, one to heal Abraham, and one to destroy Sodom. Right? It's Gabriel, Michael, Raphael, and Michael. Okay? Three angels that you may know from prayers that we say. Right? Mimini, Michael, Mismoli, Raphael, and so on. Uriel is not included in this one. Usually in that Kabbalistic prayer there are four angels, but we're missing Uriel. Okay? Now, so apart from the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, you've got these three angels and they perform three tasks. Okay? You with me so far? And that's the traditional explanation. But what I want to take you through now is Ramban, Nachmanides. Ramban's objection to that explanation and his, and I don't want to miss a step. I wrote it down to make sure I'd get it all right because I couldn't sit here and read it in front of you. Okay, so, and to explain why that's a problem. First of all, well, you know what? It's better to go through more of the chapter because I'm going to talk about what happens in a minute, more of the chapter, what Ramban objects to in a second. Okay, he sees the three angels, so let's just look at one more verse. In verse 2, remember, we saw looking up, he saw three men standing near him, As soon as he saw them, he ran from the entrance of the tent to greet them, and bowing to the ground, he said, "My lords, if it please you, don't go on past your servant. Let a little water be brought. Bathe your feet, recline under the tree. Let me fetch a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves. Then go on, seeing that you've come on your servant's way." They replied, "Do as you have said." Now, we'll look at that more carefully. And then, of course, Abraham goes off and he prepares a whole big feast. But for Ramban, he says the problem is there's a lot more here than just announcing the coming of Isaac's birth, healing Abraham, destroying Sodom. There's a whole business with hospitality, with preparing meals for strangers, with Abraham, remember, sitting in the front of the tent, kechom hayom, when the day is hot. Why is Abraham sitting in the front of the tent? The common sense explanation is that it's cooler there, but in fact, it may be cooler in the tent where there's shade than it is sitting in front. So the rabbis assume that Abraham is sitting in the front of the tent because he's on the lookout for people who are traveling so that he can help them, because Avram is always looking for a mitzvah to do, and that's, you know, so just like people sit on the porch and offer lemonade to people who pass by. Yeah. No, to give them food, to remember that people are traveling. And there aren't restaurants in the ancient world, and there aren't hotels in the ancient world. You have to rely on the hospitality of people who are going to be kind to you. So he's actually out there looking to help whoever happens to be traveling by where he lives. So Ramban says, if in fact... let's see. Okay. When Avraham looks up and he sees a vision, it says, "Vayera elav Adonai." God appears to him. Is God physical in that vision? Right. Whatever appearing is, it doesn't say some sort of form, but then he sees three people. Is that physical?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's some kind of contrast between the beginning and the next part, although it's not clear what it is. So if it's a vision that doesn't, and according to Rambam, by the way, Maimonides, the reason it's a vision is because everybody, with the exception of Moshe, saw God in some kind of secondary vision, usually through angels, right? Angels are what appear to Avraham here because Avraham is not Moshe. When Hagar hears God, Hagar sees an angel. Only Moshe is said to speak to God, panim el panim, face to face. So as far as Rambam is concerned, this is all a product of Avraham's seeing people who are actually God's messengers, but Avraham never sees anything that is God. Okay? That's all a vision that is, for Rambam, imagination vision. For Ramban, Nachmanides, this vision is in fact given to Avraham because Avraham has fulfilled the mitzvah of circumcision, and so it's a reward. He circumcises himself, he gets a reward by being given a vision. And then the angels are separate. The angels are a physical manifestation of what God's going to do for him. All right, first he gets the reward of the vision, and then he gets the promise of what's going to happen. And for Ramban, there are two different kinds of angels that come from God. One are non-physical and one is physical, which means that sometimes you can see angels with you see angels as people, and sometimes you see angels not as people. Right? Which is a very nice, you can make a very nice sermon out of that. Right? Sometimes people who come into your life are actually angels, but they're just in the guise of people. And then there are times when you in fact feel something beyond human beings, and that's an angel in the spiritual sense of the word. I brought a nice quote from Franz Rosenzweig. He says, when Avram looks up and he sees the three men, Rosenzweig says, Abraham is the religious man par excellence because he sees God in the human situation. He looks at three people and thinks he's had a vision of God. Whereas we're usually the exact opposite, right? We usually see people and see the separation of people from God. So Ramban, in fact, compares it. This is a nice comparison. I like this. To Leviticus 9:23, you don't have to turn it. I'll be happy to read it to you, where it says as follows. It says, Aaron lifted his hands. I'm starting with 22. Aaron lifted his hands towards the people and blessed them and stepped down after offering the sin offering, the burnt offering, the offering of well-being. They've just finished building the tabernacle. Moses and Aaron went inside to the tent of meeting. When they came out, they blessed the people. And the presence of the Lord appeared to all the people, and fire came forth and consumed the burnt offering. Why does God's presence come, says Rambam? Once again, Rambam, there's no message, there's no talking, there's no law. God came to appear to them because they, as a reward for completing the mitzvah of the tabernacle, just as God comes to Abraham as a reward for fulfilling the mitzvah of circumcision. Okay? That's his interpretation of it. All right. Any questions or comments on this before we move along? All right. So, what does he do? Looking up, he sees three men standing near him. As soon as he sees them, he ran from the entrance of the tent. Now, once again, remember, Abraham is convalescing. He's getting better. So to run from the entrance of the tent is a high degree of devotion, right? Because it's got to be hard for him. He's not feeling well. And bowing to the ground, he says, my lords, if it please you, don't go past your servant. Now, who has Abraham just seen before he sees the three men? God. And when the three men come along, what does he do? He runs to see them. So says the Talmud, greeting guests is more important than greeting the divine presence. Greater than the Shekhinah. Okay? If you have guests in your home, you have to do more for them than for God. Because that's what Abraham does. Right? Abraham says, you know, basically, God, nice to see you, but there are guests. I have guests. So he goes on and says, let a little water be brought, bathe your feet and recline under the tree. What's nice about this is it reminds you, it brings you back to what it's like to walk through the streets of the ancient world. The first thing you want to do is bathe your feet, right? Because it's got to be dusty and unpleasant, and you walk for miles and miles and miles and miles, and after you do that, you want water. And then he says, and let me fetch you a morsel of bread. Now, you'll notice that when he says, let me fetch you a morsel of bread, does he in fact fetch him a morsel of bread? No. He prepares a giant feast. Or more accurately, who prepares the giant feast? Sarah prepares the giant feast. Exactly. That's right.
He gives the directions.
Yes, he gives the directions. He says, sweetheart, go get them lots of food while I entertain them. Right. The Talmud picks up on that, and it says, this is the characteristic of a righteous person. They say little and do much. He says, I'm just going to get you a morsel of bread, but he ends up getting them a giant feast. Instead of saying, wait till you see what my wife Sarah can whip up for you, which would be the normal right way to do it, he says, let me just get you a little bread, and all of a sudden, it's like that old joke about the rabbi. It's just like that. It's not exactly like it, but it's a little like it. About the rabbi who his whole life he's kept kosher, and he decides he's going to go on a trip to Italy, and no one's going to be there, and no one's going to see him, and for the first time he's going to eat treif. And so he goes into, treif being non-kosher stuff, so he goes into a restaurant, and he sits in a dark corner, and of course none of his congregants are anywhere around. He says to the waiter, bring me a roast suckling pig. And so the waiter goes off and so on and so forth, and he waits for a little while, and sure enough, right before the waiter comes out, who walks in but the president of his congregation, who happens to be visiting Italy, sits down at the table, says, Rabbi, it's so wonderful to see you here. I didn't know that you were in Italy. He says, what I love about Italy is everything is exaggerated. He said, they don't have just little pictures, they have giant pictures. They don't have just nice buildings, they have gorgeous buildings. I mean, even look at the restaurant, everything is vastly overdone. I need one fork for dinner, they give me six forks. And then the guy brings out a roast suckling pig and puts it right in front of the rabbi and says, look, all I ordered was an apple. So, all Abraham, you know, said, just a little morsel of bread, and all of a sudden he's going to get a giant feast. So, you know, that actually, as my father told me years ago, when he was an assistant rabbi, when he was a rabbinical student, he went out to, he was an assistant for a very famous American rabbi named Joachim Prince, who was very well known in the Jewish community and also politically, and he was a wonderful man from all accounts. He was a survivor, and anyway, so he went out to lunch once with my father, and he ordered tomato juice, and they brought him clam chowder. And he said to my father, "I'm going to give you the first lesson of the rabbinate. Somewhere in this congregation is a member. Somewhere in this restaurant is a member of my congregation, and this is what they're going to say: the rabbi ordered clam chowder." He saw me and sent it back and got tomato juice. He said, so you should just know that that's the way the world works. Anyway. All right. Yeah, please. In human beings, right. I'm sorry, I didn't get the point. Can you?
The point is that Abraham isn't just being hospitable to three human beings, he's being hospitable to the vision of God.
Let me take that two ways. One is, does Abraham recognize these three human beings as something other than human beings? That's one possibility, although it doesn't seem that way. Among other things, you know, there is the problematic issue that they're angels and he's feeding them. We'll talk about that in a second. The other is that you're right. It's a very nice, and if I'm understanding you correctly, a very nice lesson that when you've had an encounter with God, it leads you to see human beings differently and better in a way. That he wants to be close to human beings because he's just been inspired by his encounter with God. Was that what you said? You got to talk louder then. I can't.
I'm sorry.
Right.
And in his expression of hospitality, this is not hospitality to the angels, but this is a service.
A gesture to God. Although I would say it's possible. I don't know whether that makes it better or less impressive that Abraham would do that. I don't know. Unless feeding the angels is an expression of hospitality to God only if you see God in the angels. Right. Which is, you know, look, the ambiguity about all this is that they are presented as human beings, they eat like human beings, but they predict the future, like angels are supposed to. So it's very, what angels are, I think, is not one thing in the Bible. They serve different kinds of functions at different times. I mean, just like, remember that the angel that wrestles with Jacob, you know, it's very strange. He says, let me go. As though Jacob has pinned him to the mat and he can't get away unless, and then Jacob says, I won't let you go unless you bless me. And so the angel, it seems like, is forced to bless him. Now, we don't normally think of angels as being actually able to be captured by human beings. But, and on the other hand, there's something physical that clearly goes on because Jacob limps for the rest of his life as a result of that encounter. So it's very, it's very unclear what angels represent in the Bible. I think that it's the best way to think about it is they represent whatever function God wishes them to represent at the time. So sometimes physical, sometimes not physical, depending on what the job calls for. Because remember, the Hebrew word for angel is malach, which means messenger. So they're just there to carry God's message. Yeah, and in English you talk about breaking bread. I mean, bread is considered the primal human food, at least in all cultures that have bread. That's not necessarily true in Asian cultures. Presumably they have similar expressions about rice. But in cultures of bread, absolutely.
The same exaggeration.
Even when you say man does not live by bread alone, right? That's a way of saying even though bread is the primary food, it's not the only. Yeah.
Not just Abraham was circumcised that day, but Ishmael and all the adult males also. And as you began talking, it appeared to me that God could be doing something other than before Purim. He could be showing that he has agreed to the sealed bargain. This is the first bargain he's made.
Not the first bargain, because he made the covenant between the pieces.
It's the first bargain he made with Abraham.
No, the covenant between the pieces is the first bargain. The Brit Ben Abitarim, chapter 15. Remember when he comes down and the fire and, but it's true that, I mean, it could be God doesn't shake hands, but presumably. Okay, so as soon as they say, Ta'aseh ka'asher dibartha, do as you've said, right? And what's the first thing Avraham does as soon as the angels agreed to be fed? Abraham hastened into the tent of Sarah and said, quick, 3 sa'as of choice flour. Knead and make cakes. It's what it says. So then Abraham ran to the herd, took a calf, tender and choice, gave it to a servant boy who hastened to prepare it. Now, Abraham does go get, he has her make the cakes, but he gets the calf. And then he takes curds and milk. And the calf that had been prepared and set those before them and waited under the tree as they ate. Now, what's the problem here? Right. Milk and meat.
His problem is if they don't get the cake, what does it say about Sarah as a cook?
That they don't get the cake.
Yeah.
Oh, well, they don't get it yet, but presumably they get it later. That's true. Probably takes longer to make cakes than to, I don't know. Or maybe she didn't do it. Maybe she said, make your own cakes. Big shot. I didn't ask you to get circumcised. That has nothing to do with me, you know. Now there are several answers to the milk and meat problem here, and also to the whole angel eating problem. And you can solve them the same way, which is the angels just pretended to eat; they didn't really eat, which is one midrashic tradition. It doesn't answer the question of why Abraham served them milk and meat, especially because there is a rabbinic tradition that the avot, the forefathers, observed all the Torah before the Torah was given. So, now, the two easiest answers, answers that you might think of first are, one, the Torah hasn't been given yet, so the law isn't fixed yet, and Abraham doesn't know that you can't put milk and meat together because nobody has said it. The second is that the Torah doesn't actually say that you can't put milk and meat together. What the Torah says 3 times is lo tivashel gedi b'chalev imo, which means you shouldn't see the lamb in its mother's milk. And there are 2 possible reasons for that. One is that it's just inhumane. You know, it's just not nice to do that to a child in its own mother's milk. There's something repulsive, inhuman about doing that. And the second is that it might have been a pagan custom, and that's why it's specifically outlawed. Okay? All the business about separate dishes, about waiting between meat and milk, about not combining any kind of meat and milk, that's all rabbinic. It all comes from the rabbis. So it could be that the Torah itself And this is obviously not a classical Jewish view at all. It could be that the Torah itself doesn't recognize many of those laws, that they came later. But the rabbis say, you know, look, here's the rabbinic idea. The rabbinic idea is the Torah doesn't repeat itself for no reason. All it has to do is say once, don't see the lamb in its mother's milk, and we all get that. Why does it say it three separate times unless it's implying a larger principle than just don't see the lamb in its mother's milk? And what's the larger principle? It's that milk represents life and meat represents death. And you don't combine the two because you don't combine the principle representing life with the principle representing death. And therefore, you separate milk and meat. And that's the Torah's intention. Yeah.
Abraham's defense, since it first says it was milk, it could also have been that it took much longer to prepare
the meat. Right. Yes. Right. Yeah, that's the other possibility, is that they didn't exactly eat it together. It was just prepared around the same time in Abraham's separate kitchens. You know, he had a milk kitchen. Did I not mention that? He had a milk kitchen and a meat kitchen. A milk tent, actually, is what he had. And a meat tent. And they could exactly have eaten the milk first and then eaten the meat afterwards, which, as you know, the usual, I mean, it depends who you ask, but an hour, according to everybody, is adequate waiting time. It's a great question. How about chicken and milk? And there is a comment on that in the Talmud. And here's the way it went. Originally, someone was asking, why can't you have chicken and milk? Because after all, chickens don't produce milk. And so there should be no reason. And it was eventually outlawed. And the reason it was outlawed is that chicken is so meat-like that people would, by analogy, if you ate chicken with milk, they would eat meat with milk. Because chicken is, after all, a living thing, just like an animal. And if you ask most vegetarians, for example, they think of chickens the same way they think of cows, which is it's meat. So the rabbis saw that same principle, which is why, by the way, there was even a question about fish. But I think there was, and this is just a sort of gut feeling, people think of fish very differently than they think of chicken or whether rightly or wrongly, chicken and meat, right? I don't eat chicken, I don't eat meat, but I do eat fish. If you ask me why, I go, because I do, right? I mean, I can give you all sorts of reasons, but the truth is, it just feels different to me to eat fish from eating chicken or meat. So, anyway. However, and you know that they will often prepare fish and milk separately, just for the principle of it. So if you have, if you, for example, are having a fish meal at a kosher kitchen or you're catering such a thing, they'll sometimes ask it to be on separate plates or done separately for that same principle. There is, in Jewish law, as you've discovered, even if nobody's told you the principle, we all know this, there's something called siag la-Torah, which means a fence around the Torah. The fence around the Torah is you make a law that's more stringent than the Torah law so that you never get to the Torah law. And if you want an analogy about it, just think how far you keep a little kid from a balcony railing. Even if it's a balcony railing that's very strong, you just want, you know, just don't make me feel better, don't go near it, right, we say. And that's the same principle that the rabbis felt. They felt that violating an actual law of the Torah was so grievous that we want to keep far away from it. And so a lot of the rules of rabbinic tradition are specifically called fence rules, right, siag, for that purpose. Okay, anything else? Yeah. Yeah, but again, some people do eat fish and meat in separate dishes, but that's just sort of respecting the principle. The truth is that fish is parv. It's really, it can go with milk and go with meat. So, anyway. All right. Nonetheless, whatever the reason, he took curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set this before them. So, there's clearly, you know, it doesn't sit well with the rabbinic tradition that Abraham does this, and so they have to explain it. And then it says, "V'hu omed aleihem tachat ha'etz vayochelu." And why do you think it says that? That he waited on them under the tree as they ate. because my guess, and I don't know this, but I think it's, you know, sometimes people use the excuse of having guests to have a wonderful meal for themselves. Dear, you better cook up something tremendous because I'm bringing guests home tonight. But of course, it's because I would like to have that. You know, why don't you make my favorite meal because Jim is coming over, you know? But Abraham didn't. This wasn't for Abraham. It was only for them. He waited on them, right? He didn't eat with them. So that also, by the way, bless you, that also makes what he does with Sarah nicer, right? It's not that he's saying, okay, you have to go cook the meal and serve our guests. It's a partnership here. She's got to quick make the cakes. And by the way, she doesn't even ask for an explanation, which may mean that this is a common occurrence. Maybe every time somebody comes by, Avram does this. Yes. Some say they didn't eat. Some say they what Nathan said before, which is that they ate the milk first. Tell me what explanation does Stone give?
Why he didn't eat?
Yeah.
It says, so great was Abraham that a sacred thing.
Not why he didn't eat, but what did the angels do with the milk and the meat? What does it say for verse 8, for example, is probably. Angels appear to eat. Right. Does it say why Abraham served them milk and meat together in the first place?
It says only after his guests.
Okay, if anybody finds something. Yeah.
Here against his eyes, the eggs.
Right. Right. Well, that's, yeah. Yes. And then given meat. Then given meat. Right. It could.
You said it's a 1 hour split between
meat. Yeah.
My grandfather would have fast 4 hours.
Yeah. Eating milk first, and then he would wait 4 hours to eat meat. He was firmer than Abraham. Well, okay, the question of milk and meat is an interesting question. The standard Ashkenazi practice is to wait 6 hours after meat before you eat milk. Okay? That's the standard practice. Some people wait 3 hours. Okay? And then the reverse between milk and meat is usually 1 hour. Some people just brush their teeth. Seriously, because you digest milk faster. That's the idea. My father, I came by this honestly, my father who was and is a conservative rabbi, but was, I would say, halachically, that's legally, as lenient as he could find it to be, discovered that Dutch Jews wait an hour. I'm telling you the truth. So in our youth, we became Dutch. And he used to ask us to wait an hour. And I grew up waiting an hour between meat and milk. Now, for me, it's been 15 years since I've had probably about 15 years since I've had any meat. So I don't have any practice now since I don't eat meat. And I also don't really eat milk since I'm vegan. So for me, it's not all the dishes in our house are parved. They don't have meat and they don't have milk. But the standard, I would say the standard traditional Ashkenazi practice is 6 hours. Some wait three, but usually six. And the reverse is usually an hour, although as you hear, there are other. Chicken is the same. Chicken and meat are the same. Now, I don't know what the standard Persian practice is, but I'd be interested to know. If 4 hours? 4 hours.
6 hours.
Oh, there's a distinction between chicken and meat. That's interesting. See, in Ashkenazi practice, there isn't a distinction. No? You know what? Next time I see Rav David, I'm going to ask him what the practice is. And yes. Maybe. I mean, remember, after we finish the story of Abraham, I'm going to hand out again those sheets that say what the different tests were, the 10 tests of Abraham. We looked at them at the very beginning. Once we finish the story of Abraham, we'll look at them again. But I think that I think that no one would blame him, let's put it that way, if he didn't rush out to help them. So this is one of those over and above the usual, you know. And here's the thing, actually, here's the thing that I think is worth remembering. What's the right way to put this? It's nice, but it's no real merit if you can't say no. If someone does something for you, but they can't not do it, then it's nice that they did it for you, but they don't really get points for it. In other words, if you're a boss and you say to your employee, please Xerox this for me, and they Xerox it for you, and you say, thank you, do you say, wow, you know, what a wonderful human being, this person Xeroxed it for their boss? No, because they had to. The same thing is true of people who are unable to stand not helping someone. In other words, if Abraham was one of those people who said, oh my God, there are guests coming, I've got to help them, how can I not help them, no matter what, then, but we feel that Abraham has sufficient strength that he's actually making a choice to help, as opposed to feeling compelled to help. Do you and everybody understands, you walk into certain people's houses and they have to give you, they can't stand it if they don't give you every bit of food in the house. You know, whether you're interested or not interested, because there's an internal pressure and compulsion they can't help. A real mitzvah is to do that when you have a choice, not to do that when you've been so conditioned that you don't have a choice. And so part of what I think is exceptional about Abraham here is he's running to do it, but you know that he doesn't have to, right? I mean, Abraham has his own, yeah.
Running around. I've never seen Abraham actually before doing this.
Right.
And I'm just wondering that he, you know, he's a spiritual man. He's just had God appear before him, right, the verse before. Maybe he senses that these are very special people.
It could be.
And they're getting the royal treatment.
It could be. It could be that he senses they're special people. It could be that Abraham is expressing the idea that spirit, it should be expressed through material as well as through spiritual things. And also, don't neglect the fact that this is about food, and Abraham is the first Jew. And there's just, you know, this is just what we do. God appears, we eat. That's, you know, we greet the angels, Shalom Aleichem, we sing Shalom Aleichem, we go home, we eat. That's what we do. By the way, I heard a really nice, I was in Park Avenue Synagogue this past Shabbat, and I was sitting next to David Lincoln, who was the rabbi there. I was the scholar in residence, and when I was done speaking, I sat down, and we were talking about something, and I don't remember how Shalom Aleichem came up, but Shalom Aleichem came up, the song, not the writer. And he said he once heard Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was the great Orthodox theologian, I'm actually teaching about him today in my class at UCLA, say, why is it that at the end of the song Shalom Aleichem, you say Tzeitchem L'Shalom? You're sending the angels away. That means, you know, leave in peace. He says, you know, no sooner do you invite them in for Shabbos than you say goodbye. And Soloveitchik's answer is no one can live with angels. It's nice to have them visit, can't live with them. So you want to usher angels into your house, spend a couple minutes with them, and then send them off. And I thought that was great. I loved that. I thought that was wonderful. What's that? Yes, same thing. Same thing. No one can live with a saint or an angel. But it's also rare. It's rare to have such. You know what I think it was Hegel said: no man is a hero to his valet, right? And that's, it's very wise. The valet is the person who dresses you and gets you ready, right? So, I mean, we're talking in the 18th century when everybody, when rich people had valets. So he said, no man is a hero to his valet. It's like very few of us are heroes to our housekeepers. More about that some other time. Anyway, all right, so, well, I want to save the prophecy for next time. But let's just see if there's anything that we missed on the way there. Let me see if there's anything else that I wanted to mention. Oh, yes, I did. Verse 3, it says, Vayomer, verse 3, Vayomer Adonai or Adoni. It's not clear. You could vocalize it either way. If it's Adonai, it means, what does Adonai mean?
My Lord.
God. Adonai is God. Adoni is my Lord in a human sense. But Adonai is the name of God. So there is this playing with, are they human, are they divine, right there in the language, right? Could be either one. And the interesting thing is, in verse 3, all the verbs are singular, as though Abraham is talking to one person. But then in verse 4 or 5, they switch to plural, as though Abraham is talking to three people. So the Torah is, in a very subtle way, talking about the interplay between God and human beings. They're three, but they're also one, right? Now, you can imagine, having said that, that this is a verse that Christians point to for the Trinity, right? But for our purposes, obviously, the idea is that angels and God represent something of the same essence, and Abraham goes back and forth between the two of them. And it's a very lovely idea. Of course, in some ways, of course, this doesn't work as well for Christians, because then you have to have the three members of the Trinity eating, which is even tougher than having three angels eating, right? I don't know how the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit sit down to some curds and whey, but either way, there is this interplay of divine and human that is a very nice and powerful story. And the idea is that Samson Raphael Hirsch talks about this story, and he says this is one of those places that shows the everydayness of holiness. Because what Avraham is doing is it's not just an everyday, it's a pain in the neck. He's got to make a meal, and he's got to serve it to them, and he bathed their feet, but the presence of God is there. And so it should teach us to see the presence of God, especially at the times when we're doing things that seem to be very mundane. Thank you, that's the word. Yeah, very everyday or very mundane. Because it's not just in, you know, sunsets and fireworks. It's also in sitting down to a meal, or preparing a meal, for that matter. Okay, any questions, comments on any of the... Yes, please.
I know specific stories talk about Eliyahu and them becoming angels and things like that, and I've heard that you're not really worthy of angels in our day and age.
Well, the question was about, often in the Talmud, Eliyahu HaNavi will appear to Elijah, the prophet will appear to the rabbis and talk to them and tell them, and in Hasidic tradition also. And when people read these stories, the first question they ask is, why not us? And the answer that is conventionally given is that we're not worthy. I don't buy it. The reason I don't buy it is because I don't believe that all really worthy people ended all of a sudden in the 1800s or the 1900s, when the Hasidic rabbis would in fact see, and that in the past 200 years there's been nobody who's been equally worthy. In fact, there's a great section at the very end of Sota in the Talmud. There's this tremendous little passage where it talks about, after the destruction of the temple, all the things that fled from the world. You know, it says, with the end of Rabbi Akiva, interpretation ended. With the end of this rabbi, fear of God was over, and so on and so forth. And then it goes on to say, and with the death of, and I can't remember, unfortunately, who it was, with the death of such and such a rabbi, all humility fled from the world. And then, who is it? Rabbi Yehoshua? I don't remember. I'm sorry to say. But whoever it is, a rabbi gets up and says, don't say there is no more humility, de'ika ana, which means, for I am here. Can you imagine? What do you mean there's no more humility? Look at me. Here I am. But I always loved that. Because first of all, I thought maybe he said it tongue in cheek. Maybe he was saying, what are you talking about, all you guys? Like, everything is over because they died, as though you're not even here, as though it's not possible to be humble or good or so on and so forth. I don't believe it. And my guess is what will happen is in 100 years or 150 years or 200 years, people will tell stories about people who were here that will make them out to be the same as people who were 200 years ago. So I don't buy it. And that's part of an orientation as not as a non-Orthodox Jew, is that I don't believe that there is a general decline of generations. I think it is possible to have an elevation as well as a decline. Now, it doesn't automatically happen. It's much harder to train pious Jews in America who are knowledgeable and open and all those things than it was to get. You know, I'm teaching 4 theologians to my UCLA class. In the first class, I said that before we get into topics, and all 4 of them were born, and it's American Jewish theology. None of the 4 were born in America. Right? It's Soloveitchik, Heschel, Kaplan, and Buber. And I said, it's because so far America has not produced a Jewish thinker of the caliber. I mean, they all, their thought and their lives were in America, but they weren't born in America. And that's because they were born in an Eastern European world where they learned everything there was to know about Judaism by the time they were 12. And then they started to specialize, and then they went to secular university. So that was a very special background. It's hard to reproduce that. But you can't tell me that there weren't people, for example, in the Shoah, whose piety and goodness and sacrifice wasn't as great as anybody in Jewish history. I don't believe it. I think that it's true. I'll put it this way. Over the generations and throughout the generations, people interpret their religious experiences differently. And what to one generation might seem an appearance of Eliyahu HaNavi, to another would be different. But the experience, I think, happens to all of them. Look, let me close by telling you, I just did a hesped, a eulogy, at the memorial service of one of my teachers, Rabbi Shlomovic, Eliezer Shlomovic, who was a professor at the University of Judaism. Wonderful, wonderful man. And I remember one of the stories he told me that I didn't tell just because it wasn't relevant was he told me when he grew up as a young man, he just died. He was 85 years old. Okay, so we're talking about our lifetime. When he grew up as a young man in Slotvina in Eastern Europe, if people heard a sound in the middle of the night, they would rush out of their houses thinking the Messiah had come. So there is a vast, you know, the worlds that people live in, even in our own lifetime, have changed an enormous amount. I mean, if we hear a sound in the middle of the night, we think the neighbors are making noise, right? They thought maybe the Messiah has come. So how people interpret their world also, I think, changes a lot. Okay. Next time, we'll continue with chapter 18. Thanks.